Check the tyres and the, so this is obviously not the electric car. We'll check the oil and water, getting ready for the journey. Then I got a call from Rachel saying I'd forgotten our pillows, so I just hopped back and grabbed the pillows. It was only 5 minutes away, so that was good. You know, when you're going away, sometimes you want your own pillow, so that's, but she didn't really want to take them on the plane this afternoon. So anyway, I went back and got the pillows, but, and I embarked on the journey. It was a long one, but it went well, and I got home in one piece, and obviously here I am. But beginning that journey from Wellington to Auckland, it's quite a thing. You know, you're embarking on a journey, and we'll see a photo I took halfway through, which will be appropriate. And thinking about journeys is appropriate for us as we begin a new series today on 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians has 16 chapters, so it's a bit longer than Philippians, about four times longer than the Philippians book that we did earlier in the year. And I'm really excited. So as we get going on our journey, we kind of want to get our bearings, get fill the car with petrol metaphorically, make sure we are geared up and ready to go. So it's going to be a really good time. So I want to start just talking about the city of Corinth. The city of Corinth was located on an important trade route. It was near an isthmus between the Ionian Sea and the Aegean Sea, and quite a narrow part of Greece. There's the top part of Greece, then it gets really narrow at Corinth, and then widens out to Achaia. And it was quite a strategic, as you can imagine, a bit like Auckland, built on an isthmus there. So sailors would come to Corinth and drag their boats across and then go into the next harbour. Why? Because they could save 1,000 kilometres sailing around the bottom of Greece. So that's what they did. And just as an aside, in 1893, the Corinth Canal was built. You probably think, gosh, with a narrow bit of land like that, why don't they build a canal? Well, they did build a canal in 1893. Unfortunately, it's a little bit narrow for most shipping and trade today, so it's mainly good for tourism and smaller boats, but a great way to shave off quite a few kilometres on the journey there. So there were about 80,000 people in Corinth and another 20,000 around Corinth. And long ago, it had eclipsed Athens, of course, capital, the most famous city in Greece, in political and economic importance. There were lots of temples, including the temple to Aphrodite on the hill overlooking the city. Now, Aphrodite was the goddess of what? Love and sensual pleasure. So you can imagine what the worship of Aphrodite involved. And at one point, there were 1,000 shrine prostitutes. And that was part of the worship of Aphrodite. So this was a significant goddess in the world of Corinth. We had a look at Acts 18, which was the beginning of the church in this important city. And we noticed that there was opposition, as there always was, often from the Jews, but often from the Greeks as well. But there was a kind of advocate, Gaius. Was it Gaius? Something like that. Gaius is actually quite famous because he was the proconsul of Achaia, and there's an inscription in Delphi dated from AD 52, around about the time that he met Paul, which mentions him. And his brother, Seneca, mentions him as well. Seneca is his famous brother. And so, as is so often the case, places and people and historical events in the book of Acts and the Gospels and beyond are corroborated through archaeology, through history, time and time again. And just shows what an excellent historical document the book of Acts is. So there was Gaius there, and he opened the way. People actually used his decision in Corinth to argue for Christianity to have some kind of legal status in the empire by saying, look, he said it was okay, and then they kind of worked out from there. So quite important. We also see in Acts 18 that God worked and people believed. And we're introduced to Aquila and Priscilla, more commonly referred to as Priscilla and Aquila, because Priscilla was probably the major leader of the two of them in the church. So they came to faith. They had been kicked out of Rome when the Emperor Claudius had kicked the Jews out of Rome. And so they were kind of refugees, as it were. And often people who are displaced or have moved out of their home are often open, aren't they, to the gospel. We find this so often in our own city. So anyway, they believed, and they actually went with Paul to Ephesus. And in Ephesus, they met Apollos, and Apollos became an important leader in the church as well. So another person that believed was Crispus, the synagogue ruler, and his family. And he would have been a really strategic person in that city to come to faith. And so the church was established, and the church grew. And Paul was encouraged in a dream by God to stay longer than he had planned. He was probably making plans to leave, as he did. He didn't stay too long because opposition started to build up, and it wasn't yet his time to go to prison. So, but God encouraged him in a dream that he would be safe and he could stay there, and he stayed there 18 months, so quite a long time, a really significant input from Paul in establishing the church. He wrote this letter in about AD 55 while in Ephesus. He had written a previous letter, and there'd been some misunderstanding around that. He wanted to clear that up. And he had heard some concerning reports about the church, and he addresses these in the book, in his letter to the Corinthians. This is just an outline of, it's a little bit small. Oh, it's not too bad. You have shrunk the left-hand side. Thank you. Of Paul's journeys and his letters. And you can see here that the time in Corinth is part of his third missionary journey. And of course, after that, he ends up being arrested in Jerusalem and taking that being languishing for years, waiting for something to happen in Caesarea, and then journeying to Rome, where the book of Acts finishes. So I want to highlight three things about the book of 1 Corinthians today. And the first one is that the church is messy. It's a messy church. And this logo actually comes from Messy Church. I don't know if anyone's heard of Messy Church. It's an opportunity for parents and grandparents to join with their kids and kind of get messy with glue and paper and crayons and paint and games, and to kind of have church with their kids. And churches are doing Messy Church around the place. Started in the UK. And I think it usually happens about once a month. I think of it as mainly music for adults and their kids, but not so much mainly music. It's mainly messiness. But really good strategy, maybe something we might want to try sometime. But I'm not talking about getting your fingers covered in glue or crayon or paint. I'm talking about a church that was messy because it was impacted by the culture that was around it. Tony mentioned Romans 12:2, don't be conformed to the pattern of this world. Well, they were really having a hard time with that, with being conformed to the pattern of this world. There were messy relationships, we'll hear about messy behavior, sinful behavior that they were engaged in, and messy gatherings, times when they came together, a lack of order. There was plenty of spiritual gifts happening, and it was exciting, but it was somewhat messy as well. So the church is messy. And in your bulletin, you'll notice I wrote a number of issues that were there, and I've got A to H there under 3 on page 3 of your bulletin. And I'm just mentioning 4 of those of issues on the PowerPoint here. So one of the issues, as I read through Corinth, that resonates for me is, can I still be a Christian and live a worldly life? Can I live as I want to and not be too, worried about just sort of doing everything right, as it were? And also known as why church fights are not a good thing. So that's one issue that I think resonates for the church today. Another one is, what about male and female roles? This has always been a hot issue ever since the church was founded and before. And so how are these roles impacted by the gospel and by culture? We may not be particularly keen on how Paul prescribes how they impact in the Corinthian situation, but I think we'll be able to apply the principles that he uses into our situation today, and it should be fascinating. Another one is, how do we worship God well together? How do we balance a freedom, but also a form, a structure, an organization in our gatherings? And what about spiritual gifts? And as happened for them, they found that they were taking their eyes off the giver and onto the gifts themselves. And we can do the same, can't we? We can get excited about the preaching and the singing and the art and all of that, and forget that it is all about Jesus. So those are some issues that they were grappling with and we will be looking at as we go through this letter. The church was messy, but it couldn't stay where they were. And Paul, as you know, is always encouraging his readers to move on from where they are, not to be content with where they are. Messy actually is okay, but messy because we are in the world, not because we are of the world. Good to be messy in the world. Jesus was quite messy in a sense, in the messy world, but he was not of the world. And there's this great quote from Pope Francis that I'd like to read, really about being messy, being okay, but not of the world. I prefer a church which is bruised, hurting, and dirty because it has been out on the streets, rather than a church which is unhealthy from being confined and from clinging to its own security. More than by fear of going astray, my hope is that we will be moved by the fear of remaining shut up within structures which give us a false sense of security, within rules which make us harsh judges, within habits which make us feel safe, while at our door people are starving, and Jesus does not tire of saying whatever it is that Jesus says, something like, you give them something to eat. I think that's the end of the quote. Pope Francis, I've lost sound, haven't I, in this? It's gone. It's still on. I can't hear it anyway. That's fine. Good. Great quote, eh? Really good, especially from a pope. You know, cathedrals are great, but let's get out there and give them something to eat. Not just yummy food, but also food for the soul. So that's the first one, and that is that the church is messy. The church of Corinth is messy. Church is messy, eh? It's full of people, and people aren't totally got it all together, either then or now as well. The second point I want to make is that theology is important. Theology is important. Now, it's not surprising that one of the impacts in the church was Greek ideas. I mean, they were Greeks primarily, weren't they? And Romans. So now, in Greek ideas, coming from Plato and many others, had this idea that spirit was good. You know, the intangibles, the things that we can't see, the soul and values and all of that, they're good. But material things, they're evil, they're bad. Flesh, blood, mucus, you know, snot. It's bad, that kind of thing. So spiritual things are good, material things are bad. And this had a deep impact in the church right from the word go, but increasingly into the second century and full-blown what we call Gnosticism. Today we might call it dualism, this idea that some things, you know, are really, you know, spiritual and good and other things aren't very good. And it has affected Western civilization particularly for 2,000 years. And so we tend to go one way or the other with dualism. We tend to go the way of hedonism, just do whatever you like, or the way of asceticism, which is, let's be legalistic, let's do this, 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 and this, and impale the flesh, as it were. And the church has certainly grappled with those two extremes over the years. A second idea that influenced the Corinthians was a confusion about this present age. They're excited about the fact that Jesus had lived and died and rose again, and he was coming again, but they had perhaps a sense that they could have all the goodies now, and that the kingdom had already come in, if not all, but most of its fullness. And so they were very exuberant and excited, obviously things like spiritual gifts and the Holy Spirit and so on. And in our day and age, this lends itself we see this in our experience as well, in perhaps an over-exaggerated triumphalism and using words in our faith that are quite militant and militaristic about conquering the world and all of this. And often this goes with this idea that of Christendom, the idea that the church should have power in our society and we're losing our power and our influence. And a lot of this comes from an idea of the confusion of the present age. And so what we need to appreciate is that, yes, the kingdom has come, the king is coming, but we actually live in the awkward in between. And so not everything is great anymore. So another thing that perhaps we might think of is the health, wealth, prosperity gospel also flows from this, the idea that God owes us health, wealth, and prosperity now. And we might say, well, one day, yes, but we're in that in-between phase where we can't guarantee healing. We can't guarantee a full bank account. And just talk to lots of Christians around the world, doesn't quite fit with their experience. So understanding that we're in the not yet phase, and they weren't so crash hot on that. Another word for it that commentators used is they had an over-realized eschatology. Great word, eh? They had an over-realized eschatology. I thought I'd throw that in because it's quite fun to say. Ideas have consequences. Bad ideas have victims. Ideas have consequences. Bad ideas have victims. Theology, worldview, beliefs, often they answer four basic questions of human existence. Where did I come from? What went wrong? What's the solution? And what's going to happen in the future? So an example might be the modern sexual ethic, the worship of Aphrodite today, the creation myth, if you like, of that worldview of the modern sexual ethic is essentially sex is good. We need to express ourselves. We need to be free to do what we want. And whatever we do in the privacy of our own home, that if it doesn't harm anyone else, is okay. That's kind of the creation myth, if you like, of that ethic. The fall is we have these uptight Christians and other religions and traditions and Victorian-era sensibilities that oppress us and hold us back from really expressing ourselves as we really want to do. So that's kind of their fall, ironically, is Christian and traditional thinking about sexual ethics. The redemption or salvation or the solution is to experience a release from that and to be free to express who we really are. You know the song Born This Way? Now, of course, it's I actually want to change how I was born, so that's confusing. But there is the sense of this is who I am inside and this is who I deserve to express. And then, of course, the hope or the future is this wonderful experience when everyone just expresses themselves sexually however they like and won't there be a wonderful world? So that's kind of the idea, the world view, if you like, of the modern sexual ethic, using that creation, fall, redemption, hope kind of analysis. And we can pretty much, any worldview or belief system will have their own answers to that question. Obviously, I would say there are deep, deep problems with that worldview, with that philosophy. And it was a big deal in Corinth. We're going to talk some about that. Might be some PG-rated sermons coming up. And then finally, of course, there is resurrection. Yes, we live in the not yet. Jesus hasn't returned yet. But we know there is resurrection because Jesus rose from the dead. We too will rise from the dead. We too will have a new body in the resurrection of the righteous. And that's taught in chapter 15 of 1 Corinthians. So theology is important. And just a note as we think about theology and study, as we go through the study, I'd like to encourage you to think about how you will engage with the study as we do it. The first thing is learn. You can come along and listen to these sermons. You can listen online if you're not here, or even if you are and you want to reinforce it. Starting from this week, I'm going to have questions that you can answer. and look at. It looks really long this week, but the reason I've done that is there's some introductory thoughts there for you to read and to process. You can also check out Jenny Allen. I think I mentioned her last week on Right Now Media. Listen to her messages. So I will be doing the same passages that she does. So that's a 13-part series that she. I've added one, and this is the one I've added, the introduction one. And so you can listen to her. Secondly, you can discuss it. Find some people to talk through, maybe with your life group, your family, whoever. It's quite good to answer questions and talk through together. And, of course, the most important thing is to apply it. And we have a, you probably have this at home, many of you. We have a hose at home with various settings. And one of the settings is this lovely, soft, misty water, which is just lovely just to give the plants a just lovely, misty thing. But another setting is the jet, and that just goes right, really fast. So if you want to sort of, most plants don't really like jets of water, but it can be useful if you're trying to clean the deck or the path. But I would like you to think about the jet of application. What is that one, not lots of 100 different nice little ideas, wasn't that lovely? What is the one thing that God is pressing to you and wanting you to apply as a result of our study in during that day? So something for you to think about, learn, discuss, and apply. As I was driving up yesterday, this was Mount Ruapehu, which I took a photo of. Pretty cool, eh? It was great, because as I was coming along, the clouds were lifting up. Oh, this is going to be great. So I took a photo. And as we're going through the journey of 1 Corinthians, we find that love is supreme. For every problem that Paul encounters, essentially the solution to those problems is love. So when it's rivalry and who's the better leader or whatever, it's being able to love and think about the other person. When it's the weaker brother or sister, it's love doing what will help them grow in their faith. When it's the practice of spiritual gifts and saying, my gift's better, your gift's not so good, it's actually the greater thing is love. And the supreme chapter, the climax of that, of course, is chapter 13, isn't it? And chapter 13 is not just for weddings, people. 1 Corinthians 13, weddings. Great, great passage for a wedding, but it's in the book of 1 Corinthians, it has a whole lot to say to the people. The greatest of these is love. Let me just read that for you. I'll just open and close the Kindle here so that it... Love is patient. This is just 4 to 7 of 1 Corinthians 13. Love is patient, love is kind. It does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud. It does not dishonor others, it is not self-seeking, it is not easily angered, it keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Wonderful chapter. You know, there's faith is great, hope is fantastic, but the greatest of these is love. While Jesus was in Bethany, Mark tells us, he was reclining at the table in the home of Simon the leper. And a woman came with an alabaster jar of very expensive perfume made of pure nard. She broke the jar and poured perfume on his head. And John, in chapter 12, tells us that the perfume filled the room after the vase was broken. In her delightful little book, Up With Worship, Anne Ortlund writes, Christians file into church on Sunday morning. One by one they march in, like separate alabaster vases. Contained, self-sufficient, encased, individually complete. Contents undisclosed. No perfume emitting at all. Their vases aren't bad-looking. In fact, some of them are the beautiful people. And they become vase conscious, conscious of their own vase and one another's. They're aware of clothes, of personalities, of position in this world. of exteriors. So before and after church, maybe during, they're apt to talk vase talk. Mary broke her vase. Broke it? How shocking. How controversial. Was everybody doing it? Was it a vase-breaking party? No, she just did it all by herself. What happened then? The obvious. All the contents were forever released. She could never hug her precious nard to herself again. Many bodies who file into church no doubt do so because they have Jesus inside of them. Jesus, precious, exciting, life-giving. But most of them keep him shut up, contained, enclosed all their lives, and the air is filled with nothing. They come to church and sit. These long rows of cold, beautiful alabaster vases. Then the cold, beautiful alabaster vases get up and march out again silently, or maybe talking their cold alabaster talk, to repeat the ritual week after week, year after year, unless they just get too bored and quit. The need for Christians everywhere, nobody is exempt, is to be broken. The vase has to be smashed. Christians have to let the life out. It will fill the room with sweetness, and the congregation will all be broken shards mingling together for the first time. Of course, it's awkward and scary to be broken. Of course, it's easy to keep up that cold alabaster front. It was costly for Mary too. As we begin this series in 1 Corinthians, we recognize that, you know, they had lots of problems in Corinth. But we also have stuff in our lives as well. And I want to invite you to open up to God and to each other and to be open and to realize that actually when we're open, then we give God permission to come through our lives with his healing and his power and his grace and to show us how much he loves us and that as we open up to him, he is willing to change us and grow us, and cause us to be a beautiful fragrance together to him. So may that be the case as we embark on the study, that we really open up to God. And can I really encourage you that as you do that, it seems scary, but it's the greatest blessing that any of us can have in life. And he will take us and shape us and mold us as he wants to. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for your word. Thank you that it is as relevant or more so than the 6 o'clock news. And as we embark on this journey, a little bit like driving from Wellington to Christchurch, I pray that we would hang in there and that we would learn the lessons that you have for us, for me, and for us as a church. And that we would invite you to have your way in us so that we might be a beautiful fragrance to you and to the world. In Jesus' precious name, amen.